It was an unknown wilderness. It wasn't long before they went into the wide valleys of Kentucky, through the Cumberland Gap.
Welcome to this edition of Old Kentucky Tales, the only podcast that solemnly swears that none of its participants have ever started an urban uprising, though at least one participant did help put one down. Today's title is Showdown in Motown. I am your host, Brent Taylor, Assistant Professor of History at West Kentucky Community and Technical College. And with me is the man who is more into Converse than Larry Bird and Magic Johnson combined, that is, Converse as a noun. He is an Associate Professor of Communication at West Kentucky Community and Technical College, Jason Donner.
I don't know why, but this feels very familiar. I'm having deja vu.
Deja you know vu what I happens.
Mean? Yeah, deja, it does happen.
Yeah, that's because it's season five already, right?
It and almost so we happens just keep like doing it. Immediately. Yeah. Right. Well done. Don't you have this memorized by now? Come on. Why are you reading?
No, I've got to have the binky. That's an absolute fact. And another fact is that we have a very special guest today, Jim Waltman. He's so tough that not even polio could slow him down. True story, so stay tuned on that one. In this episode of Old Kentucky Tales, our main event will examine the riots of the late 1960s in Detroit. And along the way, don't forget to support the fake history sponsors who support Old Kentucky Tales. The products are real, only the sponsorship is fake.
Has your child worms? Most children do. A coated furred tongue? Strong breath? Stomach pains? Circles under eyes? Pale, sallow complexion? Nervous? Fretful? Grinding of teeth? Tossing in sleep? Peculiar dreams. Any one of these indicate child has worms. Get a box of Kickapoo Worm Killer at once. It kills the worms. The worms, the cause of your child's condition, is laxative and aids nature to expel the worms. Supplied in candy form. Easy for children to take. 25 cents at your druggist.
This is a really hilarious one.
You like the bad dreams or a sign of worms? That's my favorite part.
Right. Everybody has peculiar dreams. Here, take this, kid. I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen.
Or maybe nothing will happen, right? If it's not actually
no,
the worms.
No, something's going to happen. It just may not be worms.
Yeah, you probably will not want to be around for the results.
Right.
By the sound of
yeah.
It.
They're really pushing it on this. So you have a... You have a stomach pain, and that's, yeah. Any one of these could be a sign of worms.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just, I just sort of blown away by the whole thing and candy. We've seen the candy worm thing before, too. Apparently, that's how you fold it down all the kids back then.
What'd you say? Fold it down?
Yeah.
What is that? That's, you lost me on that one.
You got it. I mean, you got it. You can't just give them medicine. Kids hate medicine, right?
Uh-huh.
So it is disguised as candy
I see.
Form.
Right, sure. Mm-hmm. Cherry laxatives.
You've never bought candy worms in a store?
Oh, that right. You can have worm medicine in the shape of gummy worms. Sure.
Right. Or you can just buy them in other just shapes
asking for,
as candy.
Sure, yeah.
That would be a little postmodern, wouldn't it? The worm candy
yeah,
is
yeah.
actually a gummy worm.
Yeah, that should actually exist. I don't know.
You guys probably aren't old enough to remember the worms that you could buy. Not even gummy worms. They were just like bubblegum-shaped worms.
Oh, no. Was it gum?
Yeah.
No, I don't remember it's gum. I remember the cigars. I would get the cigars, you know, of gum. Those
I remember
were fun.
The candy cigarettes, and there was like a little
yeah,
there was
what
little
a nice
puff of
toy.
Candy smoke in there.
Here, pretend to smoke a cigarette. Yeah, those are still around. Occasionally, you'll see them in some random
probably
gas station,
some antique store.
Yeah,
so, yeah
they
like
still
a
exist.
Antique or old gas station that's out in the middle of nowhere. They probably still have
yeah,
a
what a
2-year
terrible
supply or something.
Candy to produce. Here, practice this.
It was modeling of the worst kind.
Anyway, worms, yes. You like to find things that just, right?
Yeah, that's the way we do it around here. Get under that skin a little bit.
Oh, right, Brent. I see now. I see from your look. Yes, I'm troubled, Brent. I'm troubled because I was listening to some old podcasts, and I didn't realize that, like, I don't know what we did. I guess we went and took a long lunch there. Things got a little tipsy, a little things slowed down. I don't remember it being so, how can I put it? A little inebriated during the podcast recording.
Well, you remember that? I do not remember that, but all right, let's hear it. That's a friend of the show right there.
Oh, those two little kids, they're listening. Obviously, they've been listening.
Because he's thinking about the season two, right. Episode one. So some guy was Matthew Scott, remember?
Right, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Now, yeah,
you
the
got
photo...
the tank stunk. Not stunk. Stuck?
Yeah, stuck.
Stuck.
Stuck. Stuck is the right word.
Yeah, he got it stuck.
Yeah.
You remember, somebody's making those kids listen to those podcasts. Or they don't get any ice cream.
But making them, they love it.
Did Daddy play another podcast for us?
Please.
Do you see what I'm getting at?
I thought I sounded great. You sounded horrible.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
So what were you doing?
It was a cough medicine kind of a thing.
Oh, you had a really severe cough,
yeah.
Right? And so
right.
You had to medicate, of course, because the show must go on.
Yeah, I know.
And then you had that really horrible performance alongside my really great performance. Is that what happened?
Well, you were a little slow. Oh, what a lame premise now that we have to carry out for the rest of these episodes.
Wait a minute. That's what we do every season? We have a lame premise on for 10 episodes?
Right here,
but
Jim.
But you guys do take a case of that stuff and drink it?
That was a whole case, wasn't it? Or was it just half a case?
I don't know. We don't socialize, actually. I've never seen you outside this room. Do you live here?
I do, in fact, live here. And we work at the same institution and everything.
Oh, boy. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, a little fun with technology there.
Technology is what they're calling it now?
Yeah.
All right. Well, what else can I say except now it's time for the moment that we've all been waiting for.
The main event.
Time for the showdown in Motown. And Jim, we teased at the beginning that you are a survivor of polio. Tell us about that.
I had polio when I was 2.5 years old. It would have been about in 1949, 1950. I lived up in Michigan at that time, and I can remember having to be in a crib in front of the living room window, and every time I'd stand up, my mother would tell me to lay back down because I wasn't allowed to stand up on my feet because of I had polio in my right ankle and my right calf.
So part of the treatment there is that you were supposed to keep it immobile?
I guess so at that time. This was before the polio vaccine and everything, and they didn't really know a lot about it. In my lifetime, I've run through other people that had polio around that time, and they were walking with canes and things like that, or they limped really bad. It just kids died from it back then because it was before the vaccine. So,
I think a lot of people, too, of much younger generation or just at this current time associate that with FDR.
Right.
If they had to think of some famous person that had polio, and he had polio.
Yeah, nowadays you don't hear about it because it's pretty much been eradicated in the United States. And when you go to the doctor and you say you have problems with this or that, and you tell them you had polio, they basically don't know what you're talking about anymore.
Right. So what happened exactly? It gets better?
It's a disease, and I mean, I have residual effect. I have weak ankles, and my right calf, I don't have any calf muscle in the back of my leg. So it doesn't curtail me, so to speak, in my regular activities. So.
Right.
Well, that's got to be true because you were in the National Guard.
Right. I was in the National Guard for 20 years.
Yeah.
Retired out of the National Guard.
Yeah. So tell us about what was going on there in the late 60s with Detroit.
It all started with other riots that were going on, like the Watts and LA and other big cities where there was riots were starting up. It spread to Detroit in July of 1967. It spread there, and the National Guard was called out on the 24th of July, and we were sent to Detroit to help calm the rioters down.
So what motivated that? What was the so it's the late 60s we're talking about, so there a lot of issues going on at that time.
Yeah,
social justice.
Segregation issues and, you know, the...
The wars, right?
The Vietnam War was going on in that time. It was during the Vietnam War, and a lot of that had some to do with it, and segregation and other inequalities that were being carried out by different people.
Right.
So this is like the culmination of all the problems that people had with the 60s exploding into these riots.
Right. It was. I don't think there was really any main cause to it. It was more or less just everything just finally got to be too much for some people, and they decided to riot about it.
Right. Yeah. Like, well, of course, in the city is where you have a large population of people together. And then when they see this happen, these things are boiling over in people's minds. And it happens in one city. And then, it just naturally happens when a large group of people, and it allows them to express that they're unhappy with something.
Yeah, and they probably just started out, maybe it was started out as being peaceful, and then it just got
out of
hand.
And then there's that.
After that.
Yeah. So how long did that go on? Was it several nights, or?
I was there for 10 days. I was there, I got there on July 24th, 1967, and I left on August 2nd of 1967. I was there for 10 days. We started out as being activated by the state of Michigan, and eventually the president declared it a national emergency type thing, and we were federalized, and then they brought in troops from Fort Campbell to help quell the rioters down. That's basically when it ended, about the 24th of July.
Right.
Or the 2nd of August, I mean. That was when we finally got to go home and were deactivated.
So was the rioting still in full effect in, say, day 8 of this? Or
no,
did you arrive and it calmed it down in a couple of days, or what?
Well, when we got there, the first 4 days we were there, we didn't sleep at all. We were just going around patrolling, trying to calm things down. One day, we were assigned to protect the gas company because they were going around shutting off the gas mains for all the buildings that had been burned down and destroyed. And our job was to protect those people, and we could look down the street and see people looting department stores, TVs were walking out the door, and
there
wasn't anything we could do about it because our job was to protect the gas company.
Right, okay. Something about, too, when it's just hot, not to put it all out, just the temperature, but like you're more likely large groups of people just to be angry out and,
it was probably in the high 80s, low 90s, yeah.
So, yeah, and people really just get fired up even more at that time.
Yeah, and so a lot of, there was probably power that was out and things like that. I know one night I got stationed down at a street corner. It was totally pitch black. There was no street lights, whether they'd been broken out or what, I don't know. I mean, there was no house lights on. I was just there in the dark by myself on this corner.
Well, that was my next question. Were you by yourself there?
I was by myself then.
Yeah.
I was there, and then a few blocks down was somebody else, and every once in a while somebody'd ride by in a Jeep or a police car and check on us, see how we were doing. I had one lady that walked up to me, and she was, I would say, quite not all there, and she was asking me different stuff, and I just told her, I said, I can't help you. I can't leave this post, and she would just on and on and on about something, and nothing really major or important. She was just rattling on and on, whether it was whether she got that way from everything that was going on or whether she was that way, I mean, I don't know.
But, yeah.
What did the city look like when you arrived?
There was a lot of fires going on yet because all the, you know, the gas mains were still turned on and everything. And we were going out patrolling. Some days we'd be with police officers. They'd be, you know, in the Jeep with a police officer. We'd have three or four of us in the Jeep riding around and just trying to calm things down. And if we get hungry, we just pull into a McDonald's somewhere and they just wanted to pay for our food. And they says, nope, we're glad you're here doing this. And so we're just, your food is free on you.
Right.
So
that's the down payment on having you guys return in a couple of hours. Is that right?
Yeah, we had to, you know, we were patrolling. We didn't necessarily go all around the city of Detroit. It was just basically in one great big area.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, maybe 3 mile square area or 4 mile square area. I don't know
right
exactly how much it was. I mean, there was roadblocks set up here and there to keep more people from coming into the areas. They had APCs blocking the roads and things like that. And
so what did people do, or, you know, the guard or the troops in that situation, where do they sleep? Where do they stay exactly?
We stayed in a elementary school. It was during the summer, so school wasn't in section, so we stayed in a school
okay.
there. And
so we'd be in there. All up in a big building somewhere.
Yeah, it was a big school, and there was apartment buildings across the road from us, and we were sitting in there all at once. Bullets started coming into the school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they called. I mean, we were there. We couldn't do anything about it. And then we just, the police came and they went up to the apartment and we all ran to the windows when the shooting stopped, which was really stupid. But
right.
at that point in time, you know, we wanted to see what was going on. We watched them bring somebody down in handcuffs. They had his hands up in the air about it. He was bent over with his hand behind his back and he was about horizontal with the ground.
Right. Okay.
They got him in the police car, and he was still hollering and screaming and yelling, and we watched the butt of a rifle go in the police car. After that, he was quiet.
Right. Would you say then that was that the scariest moment you encountered during that time, or other
No,
times
another
on
time
the street?
We were going, we were sent over to shooting, and people that were shooting at the firemen and stuff trying to
right.
put out the fires, and there was a tank there, and he was returning fire into the building with a 50 cal, and it was mounted on top of his tank. So, and they were shooting in our area, so yeah, that was one of the scariest ones. And then,
right.
Like I said before, there was roadblocks set up. We had a occasion to be on one of those roadblocks, and a car just kept coming down the road and coming down the road. There was an APC there with a 50 mounted on it, and they hollered it with a bullhorn. They told him to stop, and he just kept speeding up. So the 50 cal on the APC just opened up. It looked like they was opening it up with a can opener when those 50 caliber rounds were going through it.
Really?
And when they got done, the APC just turned around, pushed the car off the road, and when he got it off the road, they rode over that car and a few other cars that were all parked there in the same area. They just rode over top of them. And
right.
That was the end of that. So
it's amazing to think that is happening in an American city, and we don't experience it just that much these days. Or certainly if you don't live in a large city like that, you never will.
Yeah, and I mean, it was basically like a war.
Right.
I mean, it'd be like going over to any place else where there was a war going on and things like that happen.
Yeah.
I mean, things like that happen during a war. And, you know, not that I condone what was going on, but it was things that had to be done at that time to stop, you know, calm down the situation.
It must have felt like, too, what I'm thinking while you're describing that, like, even though you trained and have experience in that, you must have been thinking, wow, I can't believe what I'm seeing here. I can't believe this is happening right in front of me here.
Yeah, and basically, the National Guard at that time didn't really have any training as far as civil disturbance. It was
okay.
more all training for going to a war situation, like being sent over to Vietnam, or at
oh, okay.
one time our battalion was like third or fourth down the list from being sent over to Vietnam. We never did get activated to go, but so basically all our training was for war, not for setting up roadblocks and, you know, calming down our own citizens,
right.
You know, our own neighbors, so to speak, that we live right next door to.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense, because in that mindset, you'd be thinking, okay, this is life and death versus the enemy, but not quite the same thing when you go in there and these are citizens and your fellow Americans. And
right, exactly.
That's a totally different mindset, yeah. And a totally different mission.
Yeah, and some of the people were white people that were shooting. Whoever got the urge to do stupid stuff like that, you know, that's what they were doing at that time. I mean, afterwards, after the riots, the National Guard went into a training mode for as far as civil disturbance. We started to have training into that, and I was involved in some of that, doing some of the training for that because of the rank I became later on, rank I held later on. So
what did you tell the guys in the training?
I related some of the stories that I've just mentioned now and told them exactly, you know, what had happened. But basically, we were training them in how to set up roadblocks, how they could do it so that vehicles couldn't get through, and, you know, setting up a line to stop rioters that were coming through, like you've seen on Ohio State and stuff like that, where they had the police and everybody in a line moving, trying to back rioters up and disperse them. That was what the training we went into after the riots there, because there was none of that. We didn't know how to do it.
Now, you had live ammo, didn't you?
Yes, we had live ammo.
What did your commanders tell you about all that? Because, I mean, obviously they don't want you going in there and shooting the place up. So
if you got fired on return fire, I mean, we always had a police officer with us because he was the, say, primary authority. So if he told us to fire, that's what we did. You know, return fire, that's what we did. You know, we were there to protect him and to help calm down the situation.
So the police officer became sort of like the de facto officer?
Yeah, pretty much, because there was probably just basically enlisted people, no regular, new real officer riding around with every little detachment that was here and there and everywhere. So,
wow, that's amazing.
Yeah,
and I tell you, another amazing thing about this was when the school was getting shot up and the National Guard had to call the cops.
Right
because when we basically had our weapons sitting in a makeshift armory, which, you know, just to not so everybody didn't have them there. I mean, I heard that some people went and got weapons out of the armory. I don't know if anybody ever returned fire or not, or towards that area or not.
Right. Okay. And also interesting to me that you weren't normally trained for that kind of situation. So
no, all of our training.
All that kind of came out of that, where National Guard maybe started to be thought of as dealing with these situations, you know,
right.
on American soil.
I guess there was training as far as the regular Army had training in civil disturbances, and that was all sent down to the National Guard after that so that they could do the training so they could be more efficient as to, you know, stopping riots like that.
Right.
On day 10, when you guys rolled out of there, what was Detroit like then?
A burned up mess as far as, you know, not all the areas, but in this area where the riotings were actually going on, it was looked like a war zone pretty much as far as all the burned out buildings and things like that.
Yeah.
But it was at peace then? Or nearly at peace?
It was enough so that the local law enforcement could take over, plus the active Army was still there at that time. They stayed for a few more days after we left.
So you guys were there through the peak of it?
Right. We were there through the peak of it to where it was winding down. It was getting pretty much under control.
Right. Did you encounter anything else like that, I guess, in the National Guard that came close to that experience?
No.
Yeah.
Never have. I myself never went to Vietnam or Afghanistan or anything like that. So
right.
The riots in Detroit were the biggest thing. And then, of course, the following year we went back there when Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. There was
Right, more writing and more demonstrations.
And they were anticipating it, so they just sent us there to begin with. We were actually there in case anything did start.
Well, I don't know if it did. What was the result there?
There was a little bit of it, but
just demonstrations. And,
yeah, demonstrations and some writing, but there was nothing like it was the year before.
Yeah. Okay.
That's an amazing story.
It's impossible to relate to nowadays, too. You know, for me anyway, just like that kind of experience.
Even 2018's law enforcement probably couldn't relate to that.
Right. Oh, sure.
Whenever there's things going on in the city, it's not live ammo. It's tear gas and these other kinds of weapons that are crowd control designed and not lethal.
Yeah. So.
I mean, the city of Detroit probably had tear gas, but they wouldn't have had near enough to stop what was going on.
Right.
Right. And we've got to pay a few bills around here. Our sponsor for this part of the episode is Walker's Exchange Restaurant. Epicures, attention, Walker's Exchange Restaurant. Wild venison, 3 magnificent deer, fat as butter, and perfectly fresh, just received this morning by Fast Express to be served in our restaurant or sold out of the house in quantities to suit families. Located on 3rd Street.
What does that mean, exchange restaurant? I guess you brought things and I bring a deer and I get a duck.
I don't.
This is a
sounds
hard
like
turn
someone,
from,
sounds like people bringing in roadkill is what it sounds like to me.
This is old enough that maybe the answer is yes. There, yeah, I'm not 100% sure,
makes
but
sense.
It's 1857, I believe. So that's a ways back.
I'm sure that's what it was. I brought in what I brought and killed, and then trade it for some other kind of meat. I guess fat as butter.
It wasn't roadkill. It was train kill. Whatever the train ran over.
Yeah, the 1857, the cow catcher got it, right?
But to even get this ad in the paper, like, hey, we just got this. Get it in an advertising in the paper immediately.
I guess the following day?
Yeah.
They put that in there maybe? That's interesting too, isn't it? Because you've got that delay. Things aren't instantaneous. It's not like you just tweeted that out.
Yeah, right.
So you're kind of thinking,
have
well,
a paper every day, maybe.
How fresh is this deer?
Right.
That could be an issue for us. I'm not sure.
Keep going,
maybe,
Brett.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
You know what we got to keep going to is what you got out of this thing today, Jason. So the takeaway.
I got to go back to Jim's story. I mean, and one thing that we hit on is just it was just a different time that this generation cannot absolutely relate to at all. And particularly what stuck out for me was just the idea that, as you said, these were American citizens in an American city, and it's not war at all. It's something. It's dealing with a situation, but certainly must have been such a kind of a surreal experience to have to defend yourself or other people in that situation from just people that are there in the United States or in the city or the state that you're from. It's impossible to imagine, hard to relate to.
Today it would sort of be like the shooting that went on in Vegas and when some of the other ones that it's almost like a school shooting, so to speak, but I mean different, but it'd still be like that kind of situation where the police have to come in and
Somebody has to take care of it.
So all the school shootings and all that stuff is, you know, it's just as senseless as what the riots were, really.
Right.
You know, there's no reason for all that.
Wow, what an amazing point. We have now turned to the final page of this chapter. But never fear, Old Kentucky Tales never fails to return. You can download even more episodes on iTunes or the NPR One app. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or rate us. If you did not like what you heard, there is no way you made it to minute 26. Special thanks to our producer, Todd Birdsong, our guest, Jim Waltman, the Paducah School of Art and Design, and WKMS, and the rest is history.